Well, welcome to Boston. So Community Catalyst, for those of you who don't know us, we are a national consumer advocacy organization actually based here in Boston, Massachusetts, but we work on issues, we work around the country with about 40 different states, both mostly community-based organizations and state advocacy organizations. And our focus is much broader than community benefit. It's on health and healthcare issues that impact people who are who we call vulnerable populations. So this includes people who are low income, who are uninsured and underinsured. It includes immigrants and communities of color who often suffer from health disparities, LGBT communities. This particular issue is one that I've been working on since I started at Community Catalyst in 2008. And I think it's a really interesting one, because to just pick up on the slide that Martha showed about the way that hospitals are spending money on charity care, or financial assistance, as it's now politically correct to call it, and the difference in what they're investing in community health improvement, I think what's really interesting and what we're seeing a lot of is that medical debt is in fact one of those socioeconomic factors that impacts people. And when people are afraid of acquiring medical debt, or they have it already, or they are uninsured or underinsured, it changes how they interact with the health system. And so when you think about just access to clinical services, if you think about financial assistance just as access, I think you're missing part of the fuller picture, which is that it really is something that encompasses and touches into social and economic determinants of health and impacts behavior as well. So so I'm going to fast forward. I'm assuming no relationships to disclose. But talk a little bit about the legal requirements for hospitals. I'm going to focus mostly on the ACA requirements and just flag that many states have done more on financial assistance and billing and collections, and that's something that we track very closely. So if you're interested in knowing what your state has done or what others have done that you could do beyond the Affordable Care Act, please stop by afterward and see me. We track that on our website as well, and we tend to have good relationships with the advocates that are doing that work. And then talking about what are the implications of what the ACA has done, and what are the connections between financial access to care and how hospitals and public health and communities can be thinking about interweaving these two areas that very often are handled by separate departments in a hospital. How can we connect community health planning with the access question? I'm going to assume that Martha went through most of this, so I'll skip through the background on tax exemption. And just also add that in addition to what we're waiting for from the IRS on community health needs assessments, we are also waiting for final rules from them on financial assistance, billing, and collections. So we did see proposed rules come out earlier this year, actually last year, on financial assistance that were quite strong and I would say quite prescriptive. So one of the observations that I have for you is that when we're looking at how hospitals have reacted to the new nonprofit requirements, it's almost a completely different scenario between community health needs assessments and implementation planning and everything related to financial assistance. So I think part of that is that, as Martha was saying earlier, there's a great degree of flexibility in the community health needs assessment and implementation plan requirements for hospitals. There's also a $50,000 penalty if they don't follow through. On the other side, financial assistance and billing and collections would require, I think, for many hospitals, some significant changes in how they run their billing operations. And the rules are much more prescriptive. So from one perspective, as an advocate working with communities, that's very discouraging to see, because we would have hoped to see hospitals really rise to what's in the Affordable Care Act and in the rules. We also understand that for hospitals, before they make any kinds of large-scale changes in these operations, it's natural for them to want to wait and make sure that these rules are final. So what are in the rules? Some of the big problems that we were seeing at Community Catalyst and among our partners were just that patients couldn't find information about financial assistance. And so the way that a typical scenario where this would come up would be a patient would have would go to the hospital. In some cases, they'd be asked if they could if they were coming through the emergency room, could they pay an upfront fee? If they couldn't pay it right there, did they have a relative who could pay it? Did they have a credit card that they could put that amount on? And this was, these were typical scenarios we were hearing from Florida to Indiana to California. In some cases, and particularly in California, I know that this was the case, where a patient would come to legal services. So they'd already gone through, you know, they had the services from the hospital. They'd received a bill, and then they'd received a letter from a collections agency. By the time they took it to a legal services attorney to help them negotiate that bill, you know, legal services was able to go back to the hospital and in some cases found that these were patients who were eligible for Medicaid. It wasn't just that they were eligible for the financial assistance program, they were actually eligible for Medicaid. So when we think about the population that we're talking about, it's not, you know, it really is a range. It's people who are middle income and insured, but increasingly may fall into the category of people who are underinsured. But it's also very low-income people, low-income people who we would assume have access to other kinds of services in the community. But the burden has been on the patient to really understand what those options are and ask the right questions. What the ACA does is flip that order to some extent. It really puts the pressure on hospitals in terms of their frontline staff, their billing staff, admission staff, to inform the individual patient, but also the community at large that these programs are available. A second issue that was happening as well was that patients would ask about financial assistance but not receive the information they needed to complete the application, or the application itself was overly burdensome. And again, you know, we're talking about a range of people here, so there were situations where you would have homeless patients, you know, being asked to provide W-2s to verify income status in Pennsylvania and other places. But even if somebody was middle income, had insurance coverage, or was uninsured for other reasons, the amount of paperwork that they needed to provide was really burdensome and hard to keep on top of. And so what we see in the Affordable Care Act is a requirement, not a prohibition on certain kinds of collection activities, but really a new requirement that the hospital make reasonable efforts to screen a patient for financial assistance before they engage in some of the practices that we were seeing around the country. And I only brought one copy today, but on our website we have a much more detailed description of the kinds of things that qualify as extraordinary collection actions. And it's essentially anything that requires a legal or judicial process, wage garnishment, liens on homes, which still happens in other places besides Massachusetts around the country, but also reporting to credit agencies, reporting the debt, which the stories that we heard about people in some parts of the country who couldn't rent apartments or get jobs because they had medical debt showing up on their credit report. Again, when we think about the socioeconomic determinants of health, these pieces are connected. And so part of what the ACA is attempting to do is to really rein in some of these policies, require board oversight of these policies in a way that it wasn't before. And one thing that we think is really critical is that to the extent that hospitals might be outsourcing some of this work, most of these protections also apply to third-party contracts. Another protection was to limit the charges to patients who qualify for financial assistance to the amount generally billed to an insured patient. And for those of us who are very familiar with the healthcare system, we know that the people who are asked to pay the most are usually the ones who can least afford it, the uninsured. So they are the ones who usually are asked to pay the sticker price for a procedure, which could be 3 to 4 times what the actual cost of care is. This was an attempt to create some parity between people who are uninsured and people who have insurance and have a large insurance company, whether it's Blue Cross Blue Shield or Medicare or Medicaid, to negotiate a payment rate. The insured get the benefit of that negotiation. The uninsured often do not. And so this was an attempt to really create some parity there. Unfortunately, the way the IRS is interpreting this is that this protection only applies to people who qualify for the hospital's financial assistance policy, and so hospitals still set those eligibility terms. So most of these protections really are going to come down to what the individual hospital or the hospital system has decided its policy is going to be. How this interacts with Schedule H is that Schedule H is really a very exciting tax tool. I like to tell people it's a very exciting tax form, but it's where you can actually see some information about what the hospital's policies are. The problems with Schedule H, I'm assuming Maureen will talk about to some extent, that you won't have access to them in real time. The best way to find out what a hospital does is always to ask the hospital. But you can see quantitative information about how much the hospital is providing in financial assistance. And then now, in addition to the questions that were there in 2008, there's a whole series of questions for each facility about the actual content of their policy. There's one particular question that I think is really interesting. There's a question that asks what percentage of the hospital's bad debt, so things that they wrote it off anyway, could be attributed to patients who would qualify for charity care and financial assistance. And that number tells you something very interesting, because we started to see hospitals that report very high percentages of that number. 85% of their bad debt could be attributed to patients who would qualify for financial assistance. Very low numbers, 0 to 1 to 2%. And what I think that tells you, if you're in the community, is how good of a job and how the hospital is doing at crafting policies that really help screen and catch patients at the right time in the right way, so that they don't have to worry about this debt following them, but they can just go through the financial assistance process and know that it's taken care of. I'm going to, just quickly say state requirements do vary. So there are states that have set uniform eligibility criteria for hospitals. There are states that, all of this that I've been talking about just applies to nonprofits. There are states that have attached this requirement to licensure, so it's applicable to for-profits as well as nonprofits, which is particularly important if you are in an area of the country where there's a high prevalence of for-profit hospitals, which, if you were to look at a map, also overlies a lot of the areas of the country where we expect states will not expand Medicaid. Who are the remaining uninsured? Speaking of Medicaid expansion, obviously we're very worried about communities and states where there won't be a Medicaid expansion. But even in states that do expand Medicaid, our experience in Massachusetts has been that uncompensated care, which includes financial assistance and includes bad debt, goes down, but it does not disappear. So the people we have to really be thinking about are those hard-to-reach populations who are not going to have, they're going to need help enrolling in coverage. Obviously, I already mentioned the folks living in states that don't expand Medicaid. But there are also people who are going to opt out, either for financial reasons or whatever, and undocumented immigrants as well. So when we're thinking about financial assistance as a safety net, community benefit as an opportunity to reach those communities, these are a lot of the communities that we're talking about. And I know that I'm running low on time, but I think that this is a really important slide. I started this by saying this is not just an access issue. This is research the CDC did in 2011. I would assume that if we looked at it now, it would be different. But part of this, this is not the CDC study. This is a study from Health Affairs. This was research that was done to look at how people who have a medical bill or outstanding debt act compared to others. And what you see is that people who are worried about medical bills, who are worried about medical debt, or who are already carrying it, start to do things like cut their prescriptions in half or put off that follow-up visit if they have diabetes. They start to act like patients who are uninsured, using the emergency room for care, not getting preventive care services. And I think that that is really something that hospitals, as much as we would like to think that they will be able to flip all of these resources into community health improvement, we still have major access issues in this country, and we've got to think about these two things as connected. This is a story about a woman in Florida that we met who, again, fell behind in her mortgage because she decided to pay her hospital bill first. And the follow-up story from this advocate that worked with this woman is that when she tried to contact her a month later, her number had been disconnected. She'd moved. So I'm going to skip this slide and just go to the challenges that are remaining, because I think Martha has touched on some of these, and they are connected to this tension between community health improvement and access. We're still seeing an extremely wide variation in how hospitals spend on community benefit and what they spend on. And so part of the work that Community Catalyst has been doing has been to work with community groups, advocates, community-based organizations, faith organizations, even public health and state agencies in some cases, to really help them understand, if the pie is this big, if that's what you're being told the pie is from a hospital perspective, maybe we shouldn't be asking how you slice that pie, but how big should the pie be? So part of it is really getting people to understand what hospitals are spending in the environmental context that makes sense in that local community. Some other challenges I flagged already, consumer protections are tied to what the hospital decides. And we know that hospitals are most responsive to local pressure and local organizing. So as much as it's wonderful that the IRS is probably going to set a decent standard at the federal level, really seeing whether hospitals follow through and are compliant is going to come down to what the strength is of the organizations on the ground where the hospitals are operating. And I will just end by saying, you know, that one of the things that we pushed very hard for the IRS to include in the proposed rules was some language that would start to encourage hospitals to think about financial assistance, that the patients who qualified for financial assistance and enrollment and needed help with enrollment together with the patients and the people that they were likely serving through the rest of their community benefit programs. In many cases, these are the same patients. And so from many perspectives, including the important perspective of building trust in a community, it made no sense to us, and it makes no sense still, for a hospital to have wonderful outreach programs, wonderful health screening programs, to run clinics, to run immunizations, to have food access be a priority, to be working on obesity in the community, and at the same time, from a different side of the house, be using really aggressive collection tactics for the same patients. And so, you know, our understanding is that in many hospitals, these two functions are separate of financial assistance, billing, and collections. The only time that that side usually meets with the rest of community benefit is on Schedule H, where those are being reported. And that's something we'd really like to see change. So the language in the community health needs assessment, it does encourage hospitals to think not just about community health issues, but also about financial barriers to care, including coverage, but other things as well. And it really creates, I think, an opportunity for organizations that are working with low-income populations to say, you know, we deserve a seat at this table, and we really want to make sure that what you're considering in your assessment is really comprehensive. So I'm going to end there. I will say, I'll say one more thing, that there's a lot that can be done if you're working with the hospital that's not nonprofit. And again, I'll be here afterward if you want to talk about that as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next presenter is Maureen Burns. Maureen is a lead research scientist in the Department of Health Policy at the George Washington University School of Public Health, where she focuses on public health and healthcare policy, including the Affordable Care Act implementation. Ms. Burns has served in government, philanthropy, and nonprofit sectors focusing on public health and human rights, including serving as the executive director of the National Commission on AIDS and Director of the Health and Human Services Program at the Pew Charitable Trust. Ms. Burns will be discussing a new user-friendly community health web tool that she and her colleagues at George Washington University are developing. Please welcome Ms. Burns.